Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today I want to talk about a topic that's very near and dear to my heart, and really why I started Daily Remedy in the first place. And that is the concept of learning in healthcare. How patients learn about healthcare, how they consume healthcare, how physicians we treat patients, and how we learn the protocols and guidelines to treat patients and other members of the community. Now, this may seem like a very simple topic, but obviously those who have been following Daily Remedy for many years know that within the perceived simplicity is an entire microcosm of nuance layered upon each other that in many ways were fundamentally changed by the COVID-19 pandemic. As I said before many times, COVID-19 simply made apparent what was always present in healthcare, and that was learning clinical medicine from the vantage point of the patient and even the vantage point of the physician has gradually shifted away from the traditional paradigms of looking at clinical literature or going through medical societies, and instead became much more focused on direct-to-consumer content. Now, that's a bit of an odd phrase, direct-to-consumer content, but the reason why I say that is because if you look at traditional medicine learning, you will see that it's very convoluted and goes through Byzantine layers of processes and protocols. If a physician wants to learn the latest clinical guidelines on neurological care of patients with seizures, he or she would go to medical society, pick up the latest literature, review the latest clinical studies, and then discuss and debate those findings among his or her peers. And eventually, they would settle upon a proper course of action, and hence a new treatment guideline would be formed. That paradigm was starting to change probably about a decade ago. And I would say that really began with the advent of the internet in medicine. As patients started consuming healthcare content online, they began to reflect what they were learning in the clinical encounter. And in turn, physicians began to notice the impact of the internet and other social media mediums on patient care. And it's very interesting when you think of it in that perspective, because there's a symbiotic relationship. As the patient behavior changes, so does the physician's behavior. And that's why you see this concept of learning shifting for both the patients and the physicians. Now, to contrast that, let's say the shift was not symbiotic. Let's say there was no relationship. The disconnect between how physicians perceive healthcare, learn about healthcare, would grow relative to how patients learn about healthcare and how they perceive healthcare. That disconnect would then lead to growing dissatisfaction among patients, burnout among physicians. And it's no surprise that during the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw a lot of that, because arguably that was a moment that created an acute divide that in many ways still hasn't fully reconciled. We as physicians were taught the vaccines have a certain level of efficacy, 99%, 95%+ were the numbers that are being thrown at us. We all kind of knew they weren't real accurate numbers, but that's what the CDC presented to us, and that's what we believed, because that's what we as physicians come to understand. Patients knew right away that something was very suspicious about all that. Vaccines develop in record time with superhuman level of efficacy. That just didn't really sit right with them, and they were right to be skeptical. Now, of course, the truth was somewhere in between. mRNA vaccine technology began all the way back in the 90s. mRNA technology to develop the vaccines came about in 2015. And so this kind of rapid warp speed of creating the vaccines out of nowhere, that's not really a true narrative, but that narrative began because those in clinical medicine in positions of power and health policy weren't presenting accurate information. So as a result, there was a backlash. And that highlights how that symbiotic relationship forms. When the disconnect grows, the reverberating effects of growing disconnect and distrust grow that much further. I think now enough time has passed with the pandemic where we now know that certain things should have been done better, and medicine has forever changed. the patient-physician encounter no longer has that paternalistic, authoritative sense of control, that unilateral sense where the physician is telling the patient what to do. Rather, it's become a dialogue. And this concept, now going back to direct-to-consumer learning, has now infiltrated medicine significantly. One of the ways it's truly influenced medicine is in how treatment protocols are developed. One of the things that you'll start to notice is that there's a slight but growing shift away from oral medications. Before, everything was consumed by a pill. There was a pill for this, there's a pill for that. You're starting to see now, there's a vaccine for this, there's a vaccine for that. Meaning, we're transferring away from oral medications to injectable medications. We're developing a vaccine for HIV. We're developing a vaccine for opioid overdoses and for addiction. Now, whether these vaccines will pan out or not is besides the point. What's more important is that we're beginning to think along these lines. Forgo oral medications, consider injectable medications. And at the vanguard of this is the peptide movement. Peptides like semaglutide and tirzepatide have reached almost hysterical proportions in its popularity. Oprah Winfrey talks about just how she uses semaglutide, commercially known as Ozempic, to deal with her weight issues above and beyond a company that she was pretty much the face of, Weight Watchers. As a result, she sold her stock in the company. The company went down as a result. Hence, semaglutide and other peptides have become much more mainstream and much more acceptable as a result of that type of influencer telling people they are using that form of medication, an injectable medication to help lose weight. Weight loss medications, GLP-1s, are just the tip of what peptides could hold for medicine. The potential is immense, but there's a learning required to it. And what's interesting is that, yes, medical societies have come up, right? The International Peptide Society and what have you. But these societies are very different from the traditional medical societies. You could argue that they implement this direct-to-consumer method of learning. And I explored that. So I began to look at various ways that physicians and mid-level providers are learning about peptides. And I came across two books. One is The Peptide Protocol. And this is developed by Dr. William Seed, who is considered a thought leader in the space. The other book is from the International Peptide Society, and that is The Peptide Handbook. And again, developed by other clinical thought leaders in the space. Well, what's interesting about the peptide movement in the space of regenerative medicine that peptides really encapsulates is that these books are effectively the textbooks, the guiding principles. There's no medical society by which you can then go to and debate and go through various protocols. Yes, they have annual conferences like the International Peptide Society and A4M, but the information is more readily available than before through direct-to-consumer means. The two books I just demonstrated, I got them on Amazon. Now, what's very interesting is that as peptides start to grow and as we start to shift away from oral medications to injectables, implementing new clinical paradigms of care, pay attention to how that learning process takes place. We're going to rely much more on readily accessible information than we ever did before in the past. And the reason for that is because in medicine, the knowledge is easily consumable. There is an abundance of medical information, and anybody, regardless of their level of medical training, knows where to get it. The key now is not withholding the information, but contextualizing it in a way that makes it palatable for the general patient population. And I think the peptide movement has done a great job in that. They don't maintain this air of pretense. They don't pretend as if their information is high and mighty and that it cannot be accessible by patients. Rather, they make it accessible to patients. They want patients to learn about peptides. And in my clinical practice, I often find patients asking me about various peptides And once they bring it up, then I bring forward clinical studies and various protocols to contextualize that discussion in a much more clinically relevant manner. And that's a distinct shift from where things were before, where when patients would bring up information, you'd often ask them and say, you know, I think we should just focus on the treatment and trust me as your physician. Don't you trust me? That methodology is long gone, and the peptide movement has really shown just how much we've changed in such few years since the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, the key thing here is, how is this going to affect daily remedy? Well, it's going to affect daily remedy in a few ways. Let's go through the website so we can then identify how it's going to change. As you can see here, this is the website. We're on March 24th, looking at the site. What we're going to have here now, instead of just the general surveys where patients can respond, we're going to have an opportunity to bring polling data from other sources like Gallup and Rasmussen and aggregate it onto this site, and very much like the Real Clear Politics methodology. As a matter of fact, thought leaders from RCP are helping to develop this aggregation model. So we're going to start to curate various polling data from different polarizing relevant health policy issues and put them on front and center on the website. And what I'd need from you is to help me understand which health polls you would like to learn about. Abortion, opioids, vaping, gun control, access to insurance, whatever issues strike at your heart and feel are most relevant to you, let me know, because then we can create an aggregation platform for those key issues. The second thing we're going to do is implement a model of fact-checking in healthcare that goes above and beyond what you can typically hear in other sources. So let's pick a site. Let's randomly pick an article, and let's say, how about this? How to regulate healthcare when we can't define it. Now, in this article, what you'll see are different concepts. For example, policymakers, abortion, highly sensitive, controversial topics. All of these key terms that are in this article will then go on to help define how the reader consumes the knowledge, and then how we, as the writers and the producers of the content, intend the reading audience to learn about the healthcare information that we disseminate. What we're going to do now is have a methodology where we can connect the readers to evidence-based articles or health policy articles that are more technical in nature, so that the patients who are reading this information can then review and look at it and say, hey, this is the article I read. This is the impression I got. I want to learn more. And the way I can learn more is by checking these various health policy guidelines that are referenced in the article, these various health policy studies and articles that are cited in the article, and I can then go and learn more. And it's important that we do that for a couple of reasons. One, every article will then be fact-checked to a certain degree because we'll have reference articles referring to the content that's being published and verifying the accuracy and the clinical validity of those articles. Second, it empowers the patient to learn more. So instead of the patient simply taking what we're publishing at face value, the patient can then say, this is the article that was written. This is how I'm going to learn more, and this is how I'm going to increase my knowledge beyond just the articles, beyond just the words itself, and develop a contextualized understanding of what's going on in that particular topic, whether it's abortion, opioids, vaping, access to insurance, medical debt, what have you. We want to provide the ultimate knowledge base for patients so that they can aggregate polling data, learn what they are consuming, and then be able to fact check what they're learning. I talked about this before when we talked about our partnership with RCP, and now that this is starting to materialize and we're starting to build forward and really develop a lot of the concepts that we were discussing before, I want you to provide your feedback. How is this affecting your medical learning experience? How is it going to influence things you want to learn about in the future? And most importantly, how can Daily Remedy better suit and cultivate your medical needs and your medical pursuits in terms of learning about your own clinical conditions and learning about medicine as a whole so that you, the consumer, are now empowered more than you were before? Please leave your comments below. And if you have any other questions, you can email me directly. My email will be included in the context. And from there, let me know where you want to go. So thank you for your time.